Well, weather certainly played a big role in our last interview, the one we just completed with a great guest, Norma Bishop, as we talked with her about the Christmas tree ship sinking 100 years ago this month. In fact, it was about a week or so ago was the 100th anniversary. We're going to talk about weather and some kind of bad weather and hopefully maybe some good weather that might be in store for us with our two guests. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. He's also a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. Steve, good to see you again.
Good to be here.
And John Martin, of course, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW-Madison. John, great to see you.
Good to see you, Larry.
Should I turn on your microphone?
Why not? Maybe not. Maybe not.
Maybe not. Let's not talk about the almanac.
Oh, man. Well, you know, this time of year, you can get some kind of nasty storms out there in November.
Sure,
the Edmund Fitzgerald and the Christmas tree ship, and
it is remarkable.
Day storms.
It's remarkable how persistent it is from year to year. I mean, not every single November gets a memorable storm, but just about every November gets one that, if it were in the right place at the right time in that month of November, it would be a memorable storm.
Yeah.
There's just pretty big, powerful events,
and it often will start as a kind of a nice day or a balmy day or whatever, warmer than usual, and then that barometric pressure starts dropping. What's happening? What's happening there?
Well, systems in general, you know, in our latitudes in particular at this time of the year, move from west to east. And when that happens, you'll get nasty weather, and then it'll clear out. And then you'll get another system come through, and it'll get cloudy and nasty.
And at this time of year, the events themselves are very strong. The cyclone events are strong. And they not only move west to east, but they have a circular motion, counterclockwise motion around them. So if the storm is to your west and it's developing rapidly, becoming more intense rapidly, it's going to send a lot of very warm air from southern latitudes straight northwards towards you. You start the day out very warm, and then as the storm progresses past you, you get to the cold side, and the winds come howling from the north, and you can have a rapid transition of conditions.
Okay, so that Canadian cold air meets that warm air from south of us.
You bet.
You got some nasty weather.
That's what we call nasty weather.
Fits the definition.
Oh, man.
A little bit of forcing and boom.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Steve Ackerman, John Martin, our guests. We talk weather and climate with them. I want to give you a chance to join in if you have questions for them. Do you keep tabs on severe weather predictions? What precautions do you take, if any? Any interesting weather phenomena that you may have observed or shot a picture of? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. And again, if you have photos, I'd certainly love to have you put them up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Every time these guys are on, it seems we get some really cool weather photos to look at. So we'd certainly love to see some more of those. So hope you'll help us out with that at the Larry Mueller Show. And of course, you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. The last time you guys were on, Hurricane Sandy was just starting its assault on the East Coast. Yeah. And the final impact of that, I guess we still haven't even determined the final. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah, it is. Absolute devastation. Unbelievable devastation. And, it's the combination of a powerful storm hitting an extremely heavily populated area. And even with a week's notice, you can't keep the sand from coming off the shoreline into your neighborhoods, for instance, is one of the things. You just can't do anything about it. You can know it's coming, but you can't do anything about it. Devastation.
Remarkably forecasted.
It was.
That's something we learned, that we've got pretty good forecasting.
Yeah. An outstanding triumph of numerical weather prediction. Nobody, in fact, I've been trumpeting this to friends and other colleagues, just thinking about New York City. And the fact that they decided to take the switches out from the train tracks down at South Ferry and southern part of the island, and then move all the trains uptown, saved them billions. That's billions of dollars, because they didn't have to replace equipment. They just had to reset.
Which they would have to work on anyway if they had to replace them.
Yeah. And billions of dollars just for one city. And so this is a direct result of the forecast enterprise, which has matured to a point where it ought to be headline news all the time. It's so good.
And I don't know if we've talked about it last time or not, but I as I understand it, there's some there's some equipment up there in the skies that hasn't been replaced and is in danger of costing us some problems with our forecast ability to forecast.
Yeah, one of some interesting studies that are coming out now is if they look at the forecast of Hurricane Sandy, which was really spot on.
Yeah.
If they took all the satellite data out, or the polar orbiting satellite data out, then that storm prediction is really bad.
Yeah,
they predicted not even to hit the East Coast, that it just goes out over to the Atlantic. That goes back to this, what we've been talking about a couple of times now, is the ability, right now we're at the height of our satellite observing systems of Earth. And as we look into the future, some of those capabilities are going away. And the impact on forecasting is something we're going to have to keep a track on.
Yeah. You know, it's easy to take for granted success, and success costs money. That's just a simple fact. And to maintain it, you got to continue to invest.
Yeah. Well, you'd think that, I mean, just the fact that we save billions of dollars on this one storm would seem to indicate that keeping those satellites,
you would improving think. Forecast is important.
That's money in the bank. You can consider it a deposit because you didn't have to pay it out.
And this isn't so uncommon. I mean, in 2011, there were, 13 storms that caused a $1 billion impact on our economy.
Yeah.
Did we see any weather impacts from, the Midwest as a result of Sandy?
We got great halos around the moon and the sun.
Yeah, it was very dramatic. Yeah. I think places as far west, east of us, of course, but as far west as Cleveland really had some pretty unbelievable weather. They had flooding right around the shoreline of Lake Erie that came water coming right off the lake, and it coupled with pretty heavy rain, I think. But it was mostly wind-driven, so there was, and that was a direct consequence of that storm. So, parts of the Midwest had direct
and
effects.
And Lake Michigan had 20-foot waves.
That's right.
Generated by the storm.
That's right.
20-foot waves.
Yeah, with northerly winds, so I'm sure there was down.
That fetch was huge.
Lakeshore Drive in Chicago.
You were down there with your surfboard.
I wish I were. My daughter was down at the Hudson River on Monday the 28th or whatever day it was. She was down there. So by proxy, I was.
Chuck in Black Earth has a comment. Hi, Chuck.
Hi there. I just wondered if you guys were aware that this is the 50th anniversary of the first weather satellite.
Wow.
I'm trying to... So which one? I mean, we celebrated the...
It was part of Project Corona. The only weather they were interested in was over the Soviet Union at the time.
Oh, okay, because I know when we celebrated the 50th for October, But so I'm not aware of this Corona, it's called?
Well, that was the entire spy program.
Oh, okay. Yeah, no, I wasn't aware of that one.
Yeah, it was launched a couple of years before NASA got their first weather satellite up.
Oh, okay. Hmm. Yeah, well, it must be older than that then, because we celebrated October a couple of years ago, the first Tyros, polar orbiting satellite.
1960, I think, wasn't it?
In the early 60s or something.
Yeah.
Very cool. Huh. Thanks, Chuck. Thanks for calling. Frank in Heartland, your turn. Hi, Frank.
Top of the morning, see you, lads. Hey, I was...
Notre Dame.
When I was a kid once upon a time in Chicago, there was this event called a SASH. And I wonder if you guys pay much attention or if they're noticeable anymore or if you even consider them a threat these days, having to do with that kind of rise and fall of a water wall like that.
What is, go into that a little more detail there.
Yeah, so I pronounce it as SEACH, but I could be wrong. Given my New York accent, I could easily blame it on that.
potato, SEICHE.
Right.
And it's, like I say, it's an event that has to do with the sort of the shifting or exchange of high pressure, low pressure.
Yeah, so what the high pressure, low pressure does is it generates strong winds. And so if those winds are sustained over a lake, it pushes all the water in one direction and piles it up. And then once the pressures relieve, if you will, the winds weaken and all that water sloshes back. And that's what's referred to as the SEACH. Mm. In the past, I know that they have killed people. People are on docks even, and they were big enough in the 1950s, I think, that they would sweep over the docks and sweep people away.
That's
what did happen in the Chicago area. There was a Montrose Beach at the time. It had like a hook of a breakwater that stuck out there with all the fishermen. And as they were sitting there, the water all went away. And here you looked at all the empty grocery carts and cars that were there, and they're just sitting there staring at it, and a little while later, this big wave came back and knocked them off, and that was it.
Wow. So I know we certainly are still interested in it and concerned about it, but I think also there's been changes to the dock systems and the jetties in order to try and prevent disasters like that from happening again.
Yeah.
You know, I would be, it would be a surprise, if you were sitting down there at the Milwaukee Discovery World Museum or the art place there, and all of a sudden you see this 10-15 foot wall of water coming back.
But, I wonder with the, this is not a tsunami or it's nothing like a tsunami, but, when we had the big, couple of big tsunamis recently where people now see the videos of the water going out.
Right.
If around the lakes, even if a siege were to occur and water would drop, if people wouldn't start thinking, oh, this isn't necessarily
a good thing, right? Yeah, it's a little too far out of the normal.
Right, yeah.
Time to turn around.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. And not go out and look at the shop carts that are that you can now see.
Yeah.
Thanks, Frank.
Thank you.
I appreciate the call very much. I got an email from Al and wondering if you guys would comment on how accurate the 30 and 60 day forecasts are and where's the best place on the net to look for long range weather forecasts for western Wisconsin.
I'm not sure. I think there's too much accuracy in 30 to 60 days. I don't think you're going to get a completely screwed up forecast at 30 to 60 days, but it depends on when it's made. If it's at the beginning of a season that hasn't started yet, for instance, if you make a 30 to 60 day forecast for January and February in November, you're probably a little bit shaky. If you want 30 to 60 days from today, maybe it's a little less shaky. Either way, it's nothing like the 1, 2, 3 to 4 day forecast that you get on the broadcast media. It's absolutely not even made in the same way. Best places to get it, I can't think of the web address exactly, but thank God for Google. We don't have to do that anymore. If you just go to NSEP 30 and 60 day forecasts, the computer will bring you to the right place. And then there's national maps. So they won't zoom in on just Western Wisconsin, but you have to use your, you got to look at that map carefully to see what it's saying about that.
So NSEP, is that?
NCEP.
Oh, NCEP.
NSEP, yeah.
Or the Climate Prediction Center.
Or Climate Prediction Center, CPC.
CPC would be another
CPC.
Place to go.
Okay, so either one of those, and
right.
You're probably going
to
be in.
You're going to start to find the right things, right?
Yeah. That's where I go, and actually, yeah. They're predicting an above normal temperature for the winter, and we don't know what's going on with precip.
Yeah.
All right, there we go. John Martin and Steve Ackerman, our guests, they'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our attention is on the weather right now. Weather fascinates us, maybe because it seems to be one of those few things that humans haven't figured out how to control, really. And certainly when there are examples like tornadoes or hurricanes or unrelenting heat, it gets our attention. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us as we enjoy our regular monthly visit with the UW weather guys, John Martin and Steve Ackerman. John is professor and chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. Steve directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies and also a professor within John's department as well. Steve, great to have you with us.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
And John, wonderful as always.
It's great to be here.
I really appreciate you taking time to be with us. The last Monday of every single month.
The highlight of our month.
It is.
Well, I'll tell you what, John in Madison has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. I wanted to call in and share my gratitude to Dr. Martin. I took his class at UW-Madison, and he has a great enthusiasm for the weather and a great class, and I recommend that to anyone at UW-Madison. But I wanted to talk a little bit about or get an answer to a question I have about the weather. And that is, I was traveling through the Great Plains last winter and saw what it was, hoarfrost or ice fog, about -5 out, and fog out over the horizon and everywhere around me that would crystallize immediately as it hit a tree or the truck that I was in or anything else. Wanted to hear an answer on how that is possible to form and why that forms. I'll take the answer off the air.
All right. Thanks, John.
And since John's a great teacher, I'm going to let him
start off. Thanks a lot. John, thank you for those fine comments. I really appreciate that. It means a lot to me. I think what's probably going on there is, first of all, you're right. I mean, the fog is actually just tiny liquid water droplets. And the smaller they are, Steve, I know you're going to be able to correct me if I'm wrong on this. The smaller they are, the hotter it is for them to freeze. Is that right?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. So that's helpful if you have really fine little small cloudlet droplets. And as you said, as soon as they make contact with anything that's got a temperature below freezing, and just about anything would if the surrounding air temperature is -5, they just freeze on contact. And this is a process that actually occurs within clouds to help produce precipitation. And fog is just a cloud that's on the ground. It's called contact nucleation. You can, or contact...
Contact nucleation.
Yeah. So the liquid water drops turn into ice, and then they start to freeze without making contact with a sign, a road sign, or your windshield or something like that. They start to freeze from the inside out, from the outside in, sorry. And at the last little bit of the freezing... the little tiny embryo of water, the liquid water that's left, as it freezes, it expands and cracks the shell of the surrounding ice, and you create a tremendous large number of pieces of ice in the sky, and that helps to nucleate the cloud. So it's really an interesting phenomena on the very, very small scale that's going on.
So, yeah, the other thing I would add is, since you're saying it was -5, you can still have liquid droplets, even though the temperatures are below freezing, and we call that supercooled water. So the other thing that then contributes to the riming, you know, if you're not moving, as John was saying, as you're moving, you collide and you pick that stuff up, is what's called the Bergeron process, where when you have, once you start getting this hoarfrost develop on trees or signs or whatever they're going to grow on, once you get that ice thing, then what happens, ice develop. Then what happens is the liquid water drops evaporate, and that water gets deposited on the ice crystals.
Oh, yeah.
And this was something I think they had they figured it out. It also occurs in clouds. And I think they figured that out by making observations of fog in the West Coast. So as they were watching fog coming up and frost develop, how fast that it develops. Maybe it wasn't the West Coast. Maybe it was in Norway. But so, yeah, looking at the development of that hoarfrost and how fast it occurs as a function of
really
temperature.
Really cool.
Yeah, it is
cool.
Very interesting, isn't it?
We have a very cool picture as well from Bill in Green Bay, who's a professor in Green Bay, of a shelf cloud.
Yeah, that's a nasty looking...
Where was this, does it say there?
Taken from his front yard in Lawrence, Wisconsin. Was up above the Green Bay area. Now, that is... Man, if you're near a computer and you're listening, you should really go online and take a look at this. Because this is... I've never seen anything like this. So what is a shelf cloud?
These big thunderstorms have rotation in them. And so part of the rotation sculpts the cloud to have this sort of... and there's also a tremendous updraft that's being sucked into this storm right at the ragged edge on the picture. And the updraft is what fuels the production of the cloud particles, liquid water and ice in the cloud, that gives it its shape, its visible shape. And so when you put all those ingredients together in these severe thunderstorm environments, probably like the one that's pictured here, you're going to have the rotation to help sculpt the resulting microphysical pieces that are created, cloud water and ice. And you're going to have a strong updraft in the core of the storm that'll help to create some of those things on the small scale, and all of that is a result of the environmental conditions, which probably are poorly stratified air and somewhere in the middle or upper troposphere, something pretty well organized, kind of putting this whole thing together in a coherent way, and you get this thing that just looks like the mouth of, I don't know what you call it.
Mouth of
Beelzebub or something. Yeah.
This thing looks like it's got fingers that are coming down to grab you.
Very scary looking picture.
I don't think I'd want to be underneath that.
No, I wouldn't want to be.
Nor would I want to be in its path.
Yeah, right.
Because it looks like it almost could be the formation of a tornado.
Oh, yeah. The rotation that creates this picture is the germ for what can, in some such storms, create even smaller scale locally intense, more intense areas of rotation that does form the tornado.
Man. Bill, thanks for sending that.
It'd be great if it was a movie, because you'd probably see those low trees being moved around right in the middle of the thing, and the ones on the edge not.
Oh, right, yeah.
You know.
Really something to see. I hope you, if go to my, go to the Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, take a look at that. I mean, really, seriously, you're not going to, you know, see photos like that very often. Joe in Menominee, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I kayaked in the Apostle Islands and on Madeline Island is a lagoon. It's about a mile long and sort of a mile wide, and it has an outlet into Lake Superior. Mm-hmm. And we've been up there several times this summer and noticed that when we put our kayaks in the morning, water is flowing into Lake Superior out of the lagoon. It's very brackish looking. And in the afternoon, after paddling for several hours, the water flows from Lake Superior back into the lagoon. It's very easy to observe. It's also very hard to kayak against the current to get out into Lake Superior. So you may have some comments on that. I'll listen on the off the air.
All right. Thanks for calling. It's sort of like a tide?
Yeah. Is that the one at Big Bay State Park? Probably is.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a great place. That is a great place. And I noticed the same thing, but not as in the detail that you're suggesting, because, you know, my kids were really small, so they wanted to swim. We didn't spend so much time in the boat. But very interesting. I don't know what drives all that on the lake.
I wonder if that would
Actually, I was still on the air.
Yeah.
The low-pressure systems on what Lake Superior stretches quite far from east to west.
Yeah.
So when you get a low-pressure system on one end of the lake, it affects the entire body of water.
That's sensible.
That's why it's more common on Lake Superior. And by the way, from what I've read, because I wrote an article for Lake Superior magazine, which will be published this summer. The largest siege that's been documented was 16 feet total difference.
Wow!
From one end of Lake Erie to the other, so 8 feet lower on the western end and 8 feet higher on the eastern end. It's pretty phenomenal.
That is amazing, isn't it?
That's a lot of water.
That is, and I guess you're right that Superior is so expansive that it's almost impossible to imagine a day where there isn't a pretty decent pressure contrast across the lake that
exactly.
might be enough to have the winds moving in a certain coherent way to pile up even just an extra foot of water, half a foot on each side will give you that diurnal variation, you'd think, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that's interesting. And actually, talking about pile up, when we kayaked in, I was thinking, good, the water's flowing out, we'll be able to get into Lake Superior easily. And on the way into Lake Superior, there was about a one-foot wave coming in, and we almost piled up our kayaks because the current was so strong. Yeah,
unbelievable.
There were four of us, and the first kayak went sideways and into the next two, so...
Oh, very interesting. Mm-hmm.
So for those who are lifting, safety tip here, the waters are really cold. If you decide to go kayaking, put on a wetsuit.
Yeah, right.
If you tip over and you can't get back in, you're not going anywhere.
You won't be happy.
No. Thanks, Joe.
Fine. You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it very much. Jim in Park Falls. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks for taking the call. First-time caller, long-time listener.
Wonderful.
Cool. Retired biologist. Fisheries biologist, and I do a lot of fishing up on Lake Superior.
Mm.
And just maybe a little clarification or comment on the last caller there. I fish in the Sand Cut and Cacogan Sloughs area a lot, and what he's seeing is a seiche on Lake Superior. I think all the Great Lakes have real very periodic seiches. And it's extremely noticeable in areas like that lagoon out on Madeline, but also in the Sand Cut area east of Ashland. And these seiches will move in. You can sit there and fish in it and watch the current. The weeds all move in one direction.
Wow.
And within an hour, maybe an hour, hour and a half, the water will all be moving right back out again.
Wow.
And it happens on that regular of a basis. The water level is actually fluctuating about 6 inches to a foot. I've beached my boat a few times. Actually, the first time that I ever did it surprised the heck out of me, because there I was having a shore lunch on a sand dune, and I evidently had beached the boat when it was on a high seiche, and a half an hour, 45 minutes later, my boat was high and dry. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm stuck on Lake Superior for the rest of my life. But could be worse places. But after an hour or so, everything came back up again, and I floated the boat off that sandbar, and away we went.
Wow.
And so those water level changes, they're not coming in like as in waves. They're just the rise just slowly rises up.
It's just a slowly rise and a slowly fall, and it happens. It happens continually out there on Lake Superior, and I'm sure, like I say, on the other Great Lakes. I used to work out on Bear Lake in Utah-Idaho border. It's a huge, huge lake. They had seiche periods also, not as dramatic as the Great Lakes, but it's a common occurrence on extremely large bodies of water.
So interesting, and contained bodies of water, because they just...
Exactly, not the ocean.
Because they're getting... they're getting affected by the movement of pressure systems, and the water is constantly sloshing around in response, it sounds like.
Exactly.
Yeah,
it's
so
a tidal thing, like the moon affects the ocean tides. It's different. No. But it is a periodic seiche, and it happens on all these big bodies of water.
So interesting.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim.
Oh, you bet.
Yeah, yeah. Appreciate it very much.
So that's interesting, because I often like to think of the seiche or seiche as, you know, the big destructive ones that occurred in 54 and things like that. But they're occurring all the time.
All the time, and really in their remote responses to prior events, in many cases.
Right, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's so interesting.
Well, here's Bill in Lawrence who sent us that photo, I believe. Bill, are you there?
I am.
He's still there. That's what we should be asking him after seeing that.
I thought you'd like to see that photo. It's pretty special, I think.
Yeah,
that was awesome. So what happened?
You know, it was much more ominous looking than in terms of any wind event.
Is that right?
It did get quite windy, but it was approaching for a long time, and I had never seen anything like that.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. Mm.
So kind of like Mammatus. They look really scary and everything, but in the end, we survived.
And the ragged bottom to that, people who know more about severe weather might be able to even have said this ahead of time, now that you're saying it. The ragged bottom of it maybe means that there's no, you know, sort of secondary or tertiary organization to the front edge of the gusty winds. It could just be that the thing was not really well put together in that case, but it sure looked it to me.
Yeah.
Pretty awesome picture. Was it a cold, windy, gusty thing when the cloud came over too? Much colder?
Yes.
Yeah, that's characteristic.
In fact, that preceded the cloud.
Yeah, a lot of evaporation and sublimation of ice is doing that. That's great.
Yeah.
Cool.
I also wanted to mention that we commonly have seiches at the lower end of the bay, and you'll see the Fox River and the East River, which is close to the bay, fill up with water.
Mm.
Oh, huh.
Very common event here.
Oh. And you're breaking up a little bit, Bill, but that, obviously that's the Green Bay.
I guess that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, and the water goes down the Chicago River sometimes in these things too, right through the heart of town. Little waves can come through, I've heard. I don't know if that's true.
I don't know. Huh.
Yeah.
I don't see why not. Yeah.
Yeah.
We also get the reverse of that, of course, when the wind is headed to the northeast, it sucks water out of the bay.
Right.
And you're just shocked at how much mud shows up in the Fox River.
Wow, interesting.
Uh-huh. So I wonder if this is why people ask if the Great Lakes have tides.
Yeah, right.
Right? Because you see this and you got to figure out
what's so calm. It happens so frequently.
Yeah, and like you're saying, it may be happening. The force may be either already gone or in some other part of the lake that's generating a surface circulation or something.
So interesting.
Yeah. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. We have Al in Land O'Lakes up next. Al, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, thanks for the interesting show, guys. Before Sandy fired up, I watched a program on PBS, I believe it was Frontline, on the tremendous movement that was going to disprove global warming.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the guy that was the chair of this used to, he was retired, but he used to program weather satellites. I believe that's Steve's job.
Right.
But they persuaded, this, by the way, was funded by the Tea Party and Exxon and BP and everybody else, but they got into the financials of that and the hundreds of millions of dollars that they spent to persuade now 50% of Americans, or at the time, didn't believe in global warming.
Mm-hmm.
So my question, I guess, is do you think this is going to turn around now that the global warming kind of wiped out a lot of the East Coast? And I'll hang up and listen to your response.
I think it's certainly a moment at which there might be a new level of understanding or at least acceptance of the fact that there may be a problem. I think, on the other hand, to blame Hurricane Sandy on global warming is dangerous to the cause of trying to educate people about the fact that there really is a looming threat here that we might have some control over. We have a substantial control over it. So it's a bit of a tightrope to walk, but I don't think that this event is going to do any damage to the notion that people are going to start paying a little bit more attention and perhaps begin to think for themselves a little more about what the evidence really says and demand a little bit more help in interpreting the evidence, which there's an army of scientists who are able and willing to do that for them.
Yeah.
And I think we're seeing a shift again from that extreme percentage of people not understanding that global warming is real to people beginning to appreciate again that, yeah, scientists have studied this problem. We should have confidence in them and then that global warming is occurring.
Yeah. And thanks again for that. This whole business about global warming reminds me about the opening of deer hunting season, which was the traditional 9-day season begins the Saturday before Thanksgiving, and then it just concluded this past weekend. Mm-hmm. And thinking back over the years, most years you're going to have snow and snow on the ground for the opening of deer season, a deer hunting season. And now, lately, in the past few years, that it hardly seems to occur.
It would be an interesting thing to really look at that in detail. This year was kind of a double whammy, relatively warm fall, and then also the earliest possible Thanksgiving. So you had a couple things going against you, but it would be really interesting to know how many or what the fraction reduction of snow on the ground for deer hunting season's been in our state over the last 100 years.
And it's funny, but I owed Ed Hopkins some money the other day. So I used our assistant state climatologist and asked him this because I had deer hunters saying stuff like this. Mm-hmm. He was pointing out that, it wouldn't be so easy to do. Like we have that date where the probability of precipitation switches to snowfall.
Liquid,
and that's like in the 20s, right? November 20 something? 15th
it was. It's moved up a few days, but it's somewhere around the 15th.
I mean, 20th. So that was an easy statistics, to look at. Yeah, okay, so as that changing. But as you were pointing out, the opening day of hunting season moves around as well.
Right.
So you'd have to go and correlate. And,
it's always the week of Thanksgiving, but it moves.
It moves around, right, yeah. And as John was saying, this was an early one.
I think the next two or three at least are way lower down. They're like the 26th or
late
something.
Something like
that in November. Yeah. So,
which by meteorological definition of winter will be our winter.
Yeah, we're already in it. So. That's right. And you go outside today. We were just talking about it on the way over to the studio. Go outside today if you live in Madison and you'll say this is the first winter day of the year.
Right.
It feels like it.
Yeah.
And across Wisconsin, in northern Wisconsin, there was a foot of snow fell Thursday night.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Pretty good
roughly
event.
A foot. Yeah. Pretty big event. And
I think we've had some cold weather in Minnesota, too, right? Haven't we?
Yeah, in fact, some places in Minnesota had a record high. I think it was Friday or Saturday. I can't remember which day. Had a record high on the same day when an inch and a half of snow fell later in the day. So it's one of those things,
Good old Wisconsin-Minnesota weather.
Yeah, right,
In November. Brings us back to what we were talking about at the beginning.
So now what's the forecast or what are we thinking about now for...
So according to the seasonal forecast, which we were pointing out, one must always take with a grain of salt, they're looking at above average temperatures for the winter and pretty confident about that, actually.
Yeah.
And then again, with the precipitation, they always do these forecasts on probability of above normal or confidence that it'll be above normal, confidence that it'll be below normal, or confidence that we don't really know. That's how I put it anyway.
Yeah.
And precipitation's kind of in that. We don't really know. Just because seasonal forecasts are really, really hard unless there's a strong global signal going on like El Nino and that's not happening.
It's a really modest, warm event, right?
Right, it's really kind of weak. Strong. Not something that's going to really push the jet stream around.
So we don't know about... We don't know about the moisture part of it.
Right, yeah. Yeah. I'm hoping for more snow.
Me
too. It'd be nice to get some soil moisture in there. We're still in a moderate... to a weak drought through most of the state, so it would be nice to get some snow on the ground. And
sure would, because I mean that's a time when you can kind of silently lose the water, And
what's the normal? How many inches of snow for an inch of rain? Or
usually about 10 to 1, and it's temperature dependent. If it's a really cold snowy day, it'll be 15, sometimes 20 to 1. 20 inches of snow, 1 inch of equivalent melted liquid. And then on days where it's 34 or 35 and snowing all day and it's like concrete falling out of the sky, maybe it's 8 to 1.
Okay,
so it does depend on the temperature.
8 to 10 to 1 typically.
Yeah, people usually use 10 to 1, I think, if they just have to throw a number out.
Guys, always a pleasure. You're going to be back Wow, on New Year's Eve.
Oh, is that right?
New Year's Eve.
That'll be fun.
That will be really fun.
You have champagne here and everything, right?
Yeah.
Judah's going to be working with you. I'm going to be out of town. I'll be in Washington, D.C.
Oh, all right.
We could talk about bubble formation and its relationship to cloud droplet formation.
Excellent, yes.
There we go.
There actually is a relationship.
Right. Oh, man. Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our guests, they're going to be with us again on New Year's Eve. Thanks for listening. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.